Okay, hello.
Okay, this is Pat again, and now we are finally working.
Okay.
I apologize. Technology is great when it works and
frustrates
you when it doesn't.
Right.
And so let me start over again, and let me also just let you know and get your consent that I am audio taping for my purposes for transcription and note-taking. And is that okay with you?
You certainly have my permission.
Okay, thank you.
Where are you in your research process?
Well, I defended my proposal in December. So I am in the throes of collecting data and contacting people and, you know, doing interviews and transcribing and thinking and writing and what have you. So,
how many do you hope to contact?
Well, approximately 20 in this round. It actually started, the project started 2 years ago with three of us as colleagues working together, just, you know, using our directed research hours, and it really is one of these projects that has emerged. We started it as a one semester, let's just see what happens, and then it kept growing and growing. So we wrote the first paper that was presented at ERC in June, and Wayne and I sat down, and I was getting ready, of course, to think about my dissertation. I, of course, had an entirely different topic in mind, and, you know, we just talked, and she said, look, this is kind of something that's already sitting here on the table waiting for you to work on it because you've already got such a solid start. So so we conducted about, I think, just under 20 interviews during that process, and I hope to add about 20 more, and then my dissertation will be compiling them both.
Okay. I was not able to attend AERC. Would it be possible to get a copy of that paper?
Yes, definitely. I can email it to you, actually. It's the paper that went in the proceedings, so it's only about 6 pages, so I'll attach it to an email to you.
Okay, is it a Word document?
Yes.
Okay, that'd be great.
Okay, terrific. Let me just jot myself a note for that. And so what happened, of course, is by doing those interviews, and it was is an emergent preliminary study, you know, we just kind of networked, sampled, so we didn't have necessarily a structure to how we were contacting people. We really just started with a list that Wayne put together, and we said, okay, who are the oldest people on this list? And that's where we wanted to start. But, you know, when you talk to one person and you say, well, who else would you think we should talk to? Then they might suggest someone either a little older or a little younger. So it kind of moved around. So when we finished that group, and I was speaking with Huey Long at the self-directed research conference 2 years ago, and I was interviewing him at the time as well. And when he saw the list of people, he said, well, you know, you actually have about three generations here of adult educators. So we started fiddling around with this idea of generations. And so my goal this round is to hopefully collect a solid set of perspectives from what I'm calling the oldest available, which is what I identify as truly the second generation of adult educators in terms of academic adult educators. And there are only three of the original commission of professors alive. So that's what I'm calling second generation.
Okay.
And then their students then become third generation, and then those third generation people, their students become fourth generation.
Right.
So I'm hoping to collect a good, solid representation of course, I can get the whole second generation because there are only three alive, and then pretty solidly on that third and fourth level. So that's
okay,
the goal.
Sounds good.
Yeah. And I did receive your responses to our questions, and I appreciate, you know, you taking the time to do that because it just helps us to focus the interview a little bit more.
Okay.
I want to go kind of backwards first, if you don't mind, and just ask you to elaborate a little bit more on the influences from your most influential advisor, which you write down in your responses as McCluskey.
Right.
Can you just tell me a little bit more about your relationship with him and what you learned together with him? And
it was, I would suppose you could say, almost a love fest for me right from the beginning. I was working on my master's degree at Iowa State University in 1966-67 and really had not planned to go beyond that because I was pretty well committed to cooperative extension. So I was intending to use a master's in extension education. I think I put in the documentation that they changed it to adult education a couple years later.
Right.
And it was called extension ed. But I had all the basic adult ed courses, and that's really how I began to become acquainted with the academic area of adult ed. And my major professor at my master's level, I think I mentioned him in what I sent you to,
yes.
That was named Roger Lawrence, who was my thesis chair and advisor at Iowa State University, recommended that I try for what was called the Mott Fellowship. The Mott Foundation in Flint, Michigan, had over a number of years supplied very lucrative fellowships for people to work on master's and doctoral degree levels in adult education and community education. And so I just sort of on a whim and his advice, I applied and I got one of these things. At least it entailed moving or traveling to Flint, Michigan for interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time that I met Howard, although I didn't really know him well. He was just as a part of the screening committee, and I had heard of his name, but I didn't really make all the connections at that point. And when I got back to Ames, Iowa, I was working on my thesis there and still wavering as to whether I really wanted to do this or not. And Howard called me. I later learned it was at his own expense. He called me long distance from his home one night, spent probably, if I remember, a good hour chatting with me and, in essence, convincing me to come there. And I wanted, after that hour, I wanted to have a chance to work with him more.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first class that I took when I moved to University of Michigan, the first class, one of them was from Howard, and I was immediately impressed with him as an instructor. I'd never really had anyone quite like him before, a very authentic, real kind of person, just knew intuitively and I suppose experientially how to work with adults as learners, and it just really cemented, or at least began, and I was later cemented in my relationships with him about how I began to understand how important he was to the field of adult education. I don't know how much you know about him, but he was the first president of the old Adult Education Association of the USA,
mm-hmm.
Instrumental in starting adult education at the University of Michigan, and a beloved figure in the field. He was probably one of the most well-known speakers for adult education in the 50s, 60s, or early 70s, traveling around the country kind of representing adult ed in a number of ways. And he was an inspiring teacher, an inspiring professor of adult education, a good scholar, researcher, and when I moved to Michigan, I still intended to go back to Extension, but to work at the state level once I obtained the doctoral degree.
Mm-hmm.
And within 6 months, I knew that my life had changed. And because of his inspiration, I went down the professorial track. And I made that decision probably within 6 months and then fully committed myself to it. He helped me a number of ways. I had him as an instructor in several courses, served as my advisor. He would have been my dissertation chair, and he went through his first retirement, which meant that he kind of stopped for about a year. The time that I was working on my dissertation, he later came back and worked again for the University of Michigan. But and he sort of mentored me, two things that he did that were very crucial for me. The first professional speech I ever gave was at a conference, an AEA conference, and that would have been probably around 68 or 9. I forget. I'd have to look back. And it was a national conference in Des Moines, Iowa. And he insisted we submitted a proposal to do a paper at this conference, and he insisted that I be a part of it. And then he sort of made me do most of the presentation when we were there, and I'd never done anything like that, and so that really was a very helpful kind of thing. And then my last year, he knew that I was going to be getting a job, and he had me officially co-teach a course with him my last semester at University of Michigan, and that was a very important thing for me, too, to get both of those experiences
right
under my belt. And he just sort of helped me in a number of ways throughout the years, through encouragement and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry. I was just kind of processing all that you've been saying about him.
Okay.
You're actually the first person that I've been able to talk to about him personally. So I'm jotting notes and listening at the same time. I know we're taping, but the notes help me afterwards for where I want my emphasis to go.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen, have you ever seen my webpage?
Yeah, oh yes. Oh, are you kidding?
Yeah, well,
that's one of the things I wanted to tell you.
I have a personal vita section,
mm-hmm.
and I've got some material in there on Howard McCluskey, and
okay.
I've actually written a couple of journal articles about Howard, and then when he passed away, I had a good relationship with his wife, and he passed away, and his wife, well, the University of Michigan got most of his, or a lot of his materials went to the archives at the University of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
But I was in conversation with Helen, and she said, well, there's a lot of materials here that they didn't take. Would you like them? And for some reason that I'll never understand, the archivist made big mistakes as far as I was concerned. It appeared to me that they just kind of took representative printed materials of his, because I went to the archives at Michigan, and actually I had duplicates of most of the stuff. They left all of his primary stuff.
Mm.
And so I have boxes of materials now in my house here that primary materials, handwritten notes, notes he wrote on speeches that he gave, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I hope once I retire and free up some time, I'm hoping to do more with that material. I don't know if I'll eventually write a biography or some more journal articles, but I feel more of his story and the contributions he made needs to be told, because he was sort of a silent, a tremendous, powerful figure, but more an introvert in some ways, extrovert in other ways, but he didn't self-proclaim himself,
mm-hmm.
And whereas Malcolm Knowles, who I have a lot of respect for, but Malcolm was a self-promoter, and Malcolm, you know, was a very public kind of a figure, and in many respects, I believe that Howard made as many, if perhaps not even more, contributions than someone like Malcolm Knowles, but he just never promoted himself as much. So there's a lot of his story that needs to be told, and I'm hoping that I can do some of that in the future.
Right, absolutely. That's not the first time I've heard people talk about some of the quieter figures.
Yeah.
Glenn Jensen is another one that I spoke
Absolutely.
To, who is actually still alive.
Right.
He was another one that, of his former students and people that know him, knew him, you know, for quite some time, said the same thing. Very quiet and humble, but accomplished many things. That,
Absolutely.
And does not self-proclaim. In fact, I interviewed him and put an application in him for the Hall of Fame, and I couldn't get him to tell me. Enough. I had to go talk to other people to get, you know, his accomplishments. So given the chance to say, this is your moment, you know, go ahead and let it out. Nope. He just was like, no, I was just doing my job.
Yeah. Well, that like you say, there are several during that era who I think it was when they, you know, if you think about the socialization process that they went through, having been born probably in the late part of the 1800s, early part of the 1900s,
mm-hmm.
and the notion of self-proclamation was not a part of the way they were born and raised.
I
mean, you did your duty, you did your work, and you didn't make a big deal out of it. So I think there were a lot of people, like you say, that were like that.
I wonder if we need a little more of that again.
Oh, absolutely.
In the
There's
world.
No question about it.
I think
we've gone way too far the other way, and I suppose I don't know if there's a way to back out of that or not, the way media is today. The good old days, do we ever return to them or do we recycle?
I don't know
the answer.
Good question. You have that in your responses. I want to get to that, too. And actually, I was going to ask you... I'm going to back up even a little bit further, and I appreciate that story about how you got into your doctoral program. Again, that's a common pattern that people never intended to go that route, but they
mm-hmm.
got hooked in and enticed and, you know, found that it was a wonderful place to be, and it was one of those in the moment, the right time, and the right place.
Yeah.
In terms of being a county extension agent, how did you make that choice?
I, as a youngster, I was a very, I'm by design, I'm an introvert, and I was a very shy person growing up, and 4-H, are you familiar with the 4-H program?
Absolutely, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I joined 4-H as probably about a 10-year-old, and that really is the organization that kind of brought out of me some positive nature, enhanced my self-concept, et cetera. And I was involved in 4-H until I went to college. And even in the last couple of years, my junior, senior year of high school, became quite involved with it at regional and state level as what they called a kind of a junior leader, and really knew that I had received a lot of value from that. Then
right.
I went through some, probably because of my shyness, et cetera, I went through some struggles kind of trying to find myself, and it took me 8 years to do my undergraduate. I went to school for a little while. I was in the Navy a couple of years. I was working a couple of years, doing school part-time, and just didn't know what I wanted to do. And so finally, my last 2 years of college, when I was going fairly much full-time finally at Michigan State University, I was in the Agricultural Economics Department and had the Rural Sociology major, because I sort of in the back of my mind thought, well, maybe Extension and 4-H would be a possibility. It wasn't real sure of that, but the more I got involved with it, the more I thought, well, that is something that would be a career route for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then the summer in between my junior senior year, I had a summer internship, what they call the summer 4-H agent, and I worked for a pretty large county, Grand Rapids, Michigan, and Kent County in Michigan, and ran the county fair that summer.
Mm-hmm.
and helped kids with judging, learning how to judge dairy cows, and did a number of other things. And it was just a very, very satisfactory kind of thing. So interestingly, sort of as almost an aside, and by the way, Pat, you have to understand, my students get a kick out of it. They ask me what's a simple question that turns into a 20-minute answer.
It's supposed to. You're doing fine.
we'll give you lots of data here. But during that whole experience, having been pretty driven by wanting to do it, up until then, even though I was having some difficulty figuring out where I wanted to go, that also meant that my grades weren't so great. And I had done real well in high school grade-wise, but college, just because I didn't know where I wanted to go, I was struggling to maintain even a B average. And finally, that last year, when I knew what I wanted to do, I got straight A's my senior year, and everything was all, from that point on, everything was simple. Now, to remind you, I was a little bit older
right.
than the typical person, but I was really driven, goal-directed, just breezed through that year easily, and then started in Extension either late summer or early fall of 64. Is that right? Yeah, 64. No, 62. 64, 58. I have to think back. I think it was 64 is when I started full-time in Extension in the state of Iowa.
Okay.
But even then, I began in my primary responsibility. I was in a county where there were three Extension agents, a home economist, the county Extension director, and I was supposed to be the youth director. And so my responsibilities were 4-H, so running county fairs and judging, helping kids to judge and all these same kinds of things, which I found very satisfying. But one of my responsibilities that I really hadn't had during my summer experience was leader training.
Mm-hmm.
All the volunteer leaders needed periodic training, and I started doing that and conducting these leadership training things. And, you know, it was only probably 5 or 6 months, and I realized, hey, I'm enjoying working with the parents and doing what we now would call adult education.
Right.
I enjoyed that a lot more than working with the kids. And that recognition, I probably actually started I suppose, even slighting a little bit the youth side, because I began to spend even more of my time doing leader training. And the state began to recognize that because I was setting up and conducting really good leadership training programs. And they started having me mentor other agents, and they had me compile some materials, develop some materials about what I was doing. And then when they recommended that I come in to Iowa State University and get my master's,
mm-hmm.
which I did, because their intent was to put me back out in an area agency for extension so that I would basically do area-wide training for leadership development and so on. And that's, as I said earlier, my career expectation was to do that until I got diverted over into the professorial side.
So in each case, it was things that happened that were sort of presented to you that kind of kept steering you differently.
Sure, the exigencies or epiphanies or whatever
yes.
of life
uh-huh.
that happened to pop up.
Right.
I love chaos theory because, mm-hmm. you know, we all live by chaos. Our lives are all very chaotic and unpredictable.
Mm-hmm. It's true, very true. And it's interesting that even though the actual field of adult education was really just beginning at that point to become such a thing, but that leadership training is where you can obviously look back and say, I was an adult educator.
Absolutely,
then that's
yeah.
where I started becoming one. That's where I was one, yeah.
And this is why I say to people, you know, I've been an adult educator since 1964.
Absolutely.
And it's very
mm-hmm.
true. It's
yes.
been...
And that actually, when we ask that question, how many years have you been in the field, sometimes I get the... Well, you mean as a professor, or you mean how long do I see myself as an adult educator?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, my response, of course, is no, how long have you seen yourself that way? So,
right.
Because that's important. Okay, let me see. I think I want to catapult forward a minute. Look back at my questions here. Oh, you mentioned a little bit about Meyer Henry at University of Nebraska.
Uh-huh.
And I have yet to find someone who was his student, although I think, and I wanted to ask you if you know, was Robert Mason his student? He got his doctorate at University of Nebraska.
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. I'll keep searching.
It could have been. I'm not sure of that.
Okay.
Did you know Alan Knox taught at Nebraska?
Yes, I know that he taught there.
Yeah, and Carol Lunener taught there.
Right.
And I taught there. Yeah, there were a lot of students now. How many of them sort of made it into, you know, into a level where you would start picking up their names? That's
right.
That's another kind of thing.
Right, exactly, yes. And that is part of it.
Yeah.
Because
Wesley had literally hundreds and hundreds of advisees. He was probably one of the most prolific doctoral advisors of anyone that I've ever met. It's just incredible. So I always thought Howard McCluskey had a lot of advisees, but I think Wes probably had more than probably anyone else. But again, a lot of them stayed working at the state level and so on. So I don't know for sure. I could think about it for a while. If that's important to you, I could think about it and probably come up with some names.
Okay.
I don't know that I'd have contact information for them.
And actually, and if you do, and that, you know, if you do come up with someone, if you want to just, you know, send me an email or something, and I can find the contact information. I'm getting very good at being a detective.
Okay.
So, yeah, I am interested in speaking with someone who worked directly with him, like you, and you're just, you know, you're talking about McCluskey, that same kind of a sense of what did Wesley Meyer Henry give you that you then took forth, and that kind of thing, that mentoring relationship. So, and I haven't, Robert Mason just retired out at NIU, and I have not been able to get in touch with him yet directly. So, so that's one of those little questions that's still on my little chart here as to who his actual major professor or mentor was.
Okay.
So, anyway, but you mentioned Meyer Henry and when you were there as being somewhat of a mentor while you were teaching at Nebraska, correct?
Right.
And anything you'd like to talk about him and
right.
what he meant to you?
He was probably, I would say, I've had a lot of experience as a department chair, And my first job as department chair was at Iowa State University in 1976. I'd been a professor full-time at Nebraska, 70 through 76. In September of 76, I moved over to Iowa State University and became the department chair there. And I think Howard McCluskey, I just absolutely love. I couldn't have asked for a better overall mentor, et cetera. But Howard wasn't the most organized person, and he actually was not the departmental chair. Gail Jensen, who was my dissertation advisor, was the chair of adult ed at Michigan when I was there. But I don't think what I knew of Howard, I don't think that he would have been a real good role model for being a department chair.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Wesley Meyer Henry, on the other hand, was a perfect mentor or model on how to be a department chair.
Okay.
And what Howard did is, new people coming in, he knew, because of the publish and perish pressures that were existing, especially for young professors, he, in essence, cut your first year there, he cut your teaching load way down. And he kept you off of committees and so on. And he knew, he didn't put direct pressure on, but it was very clear that he was doing this because he wanted you to get a good start on your research and your publications and so on. And he kind of left you alone to do that, but was always available, ready to help you if you needed it, et cetera. And for me, that was perfect. I mean, I took advantage of it big time, got a couple of good research projects underway. I had my first article published by the end of that first year and was off and running on the promotion and tenure track. And the way he ran a department was good. We grew from a department of, I think when I came on board, we had 4 people, and eventually it grew to about 17 people. It was at one point, I think the largest, with the exception of perhaps North Carolina, perhaps the largest department, and then it went through financial difficulties, and it's much smaller today. But he could handle it well at either a small level or at a very large level. So he was just a good administrator. He actually had come out of, I think he had been an assistant dean in the Teachers College, is what they call the School of Education or College of Education at Nebraska. And he was the assistant dean, and I forget what all he did prior to that. So we had good administrative experiences, and he had just a good way of working with people and could get you to do things that you never thought that you would be doing, and he did it in a very pleasant kind of way. So I think I modeled a lot of my, quote, department chairmanship kind of skills after him.
Right. That's interesting. So that each of them offered you a different kind of a role model.
Yeah, exactly.
But each of them having their own particular value.
Right, and Howard, as I said, was the good teacher and stuff. Wes Meyer Henry wasn't really a very good teacher, at least from what I was told by other students.
Right.
But in terms of being an advisor for research and being the administrator, he fit those roles very well.
Right. And let's face it, I think what we all know now that people have their personal strengths.
Exactly.
Things that seem to fit what it is they're good at, and so sometimes it's good to just let them do that.
Yeah.
So if he wasn't a good teacher.
By the way, I've never wanted to be a department chair. I've done it only because circumstances set themselves up that way.
I've
never really liked doing that. I think I've been adequate at it, but it's not something that I strive to do, and I've never used it as a stepping stone to try to move into central administration or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
My real joy, satisfaction comes from teaching and working with students, and that's always been true, and I think it's true today.
At a recent department meeting at USF, there was some discussion about actually rearranging responsibilities so that those who are proficient teachers can teach more and worry less about the publisher perish, and then vice versa. Those who can have the strength to be more prolific and everything else would have more time. And I thought that was a great idea.
And by the way, that's a recycled idea.
Okay.
That idea has been discussed at many institutions over the years, And I think if you trace back through Chronicle of Higher Education back into probably 50s and 60s, you'll right on up, you'll see some similar kinds of discussion, if that's of interest. I think we go through that, and we realize that people have certain kinds of strengths. I think what my own feeling why that eventually breaks down is that the promotion and tenure committees, in the long run, they may give lip service to good teaching and good community service and stuff, but when it really comes down to the nitty-gritty hard stuff, I think P&T committees give more weight to the publications, and that's why I think that ultimately fails. Now, that's one person's view of it. But
well, I think a lot of people would share that view as well, yeah. That the almighty publication is what cements your competencies.
Yeah, unfortunately.
So, yes, very much so. I agree. But we're not going to solve the problems of higher ed today.
Okay, darn. I was hoping we could.
Okay. So that was Meyer-Henry extension. Okay. Let me flip through your answers here because I made some notes I wanted to also ask you about. Some common comments have been coming up regarding the people's perspectives of the national organizations. And, of course, in particular, the two that are discussed the most are the Commission of Professors and then the overall national, you know, either AEA, AAAE, AAACE, whichever you felt more connected to. And you had some comments in here, and I'm going to start with the Commission of Professors, and you wrote that you thought it had more influence in the 60s up to the 80s than it does now. You feel that it's still playing a valuable role for professors to gather, exchange ideas, et cetera. And my question is, how effective, beyond that, how effective do you think they are now? And also, how could, if they were more influential from the 60s to the 80s, what do you feel that they were doing right at that point in time? And looking back, how would you want to advise this group to change, to, you know, to move along or to regain some of that influence?
Wow. That's
a big question.
That requires a three-hour answer. So we have the rest.
Wait, let me
morning.
See if there's enough tape left on my...
I was part of my past career, like Wayne, I have been past president of Commission of Professors. I did that 2 years back, several years ago. When I first became involved as a professor, actually even before I was a professor, Howard was dragging me to Commission of Professors meetings in the late 60s, and that was the best thing he could have done because I saw what the organization was becoming at that time and what I think it became through the 70s and probably even the early 80s and then began to change. We used to have almost a separate organization in almost every aspect from AAA, back then AEA. There's always been this connection because AEA members and leaders, by the way, AEA and now AAACE often has headed, the majority of its leadership come from professors.
Right.
But back in then, most of the leaders were professors, or at least a goodly share of them. And so when they started the Commission of Professors, there was this natural inclination, I guess, and connection to the old AEA of the U.S. of A. And so it had this, I don't know if it was legal or what the connection, I'd have to go back and read on that to figure that out, and you may know more of that than I do. But it was like almost a separate entity because back in late 60s and probably throughout the 70s, I could be wrong on that, but certainly for several years into the 70s, we had separate meetings. They would always, as I recall, they would always be at the front end of the national meeting, but they would be in a different hotel, not necessarily a different city, although I think in one instance it was a neighboring city to where the national convention. So we felt like this powerful entity that was growing each year in membership, and we would have a 2 or 3 day conference, and you know, we gathered our, you know, collected our own money and had our own programs and had our own committees to plan the conference, and we had very powerful speakers, and we were creating curricular materials and sharing curricular materials and giving presentations, and I think always trying to be careful not to duplicate too much of what AERC did, although AERC and the Commission of Professors, the if you looked at those membership lists, they there was a lot of similarity. People were involved with both organizations. So it was really a powerful force for professors and, mm-hmm. and for building the professoriate, so to speak. And then graduate students were invited and played a fairly active role, especially those graduate students wanting to be professors. And you just felt very good about it. We had a pretty good membership. I don't know the numbers. I don't know what we ever reached in our height, but we would have, as I recall, sometimes 200-300 members. People would show up for our annual conference. We had a lot of Canadians. And that probably, the reason we had the Canadians, I think, was that there was no requirement, as there is today, there was no requirement that you had to pay the registration fee for the national conference. So we had a lot of Canadians who would come in just for the Commission of Professors.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, I think those are some of the reasons why it was growing and very powerful, and I think we were doing a lot of good things. Then as the AEA and NAPSE merged and as they continued to have financial difficulties and so on, not having been into the leadership of AEA or AAAC like Wayne is, she would know all of this history a lot better than I do. I was never interested in getting into that part of the leadership of the national organization. But I think there were financial and other reasons to kind of squeeze in, if that's the best term, to make the Commission of Professors kind of a natural part of the meeting, either before or after. In the last few years, some of the sessions of Commission Professors have been right within the national meeting, and the requirement that they pay the registration fee for the whole conference. And
mm-hmm.
we began to lose a lot of people, and especially a lot of the Canadians, and I think that really hurt us in a number of ways. I am one. I don't know how many people would support me in this. I have been kind of quietly pushing this for, you know, many years. Wayne probably has heard me say this too, and I have no idea what her stance would be. It might be completely different than my own. But I believe we should pull out. I felt this way for a long time. We should pull away and form our own, like we used to have, separate association. And sure, we would struggle in the beginning financially and so on, but I think we would get a lot of professors coming back and build us back into our own professional group and run our own meetings separate. Now, whether or not this would have a more formal connection with AERC, that would certainly be one possibility. You could have the AERC and the Commission of Professors meeting at the same time or one just before the other one, and that would cut down on travel, et cetera. But
mm-hmm.
a fairly long-winded answer, but that's kind of my take on everything.
Right. No, not That's not long-winded and some interesting perspectives on that. Okay, we covered that. In another of your answers, I'm trying to find where I underlined it, because you mentioned just a little bit just now and somewhere in here, and I'll find it in a second, but being sort of being personally unwilling to take a more leadership role within the field, I'm assuming you're referring kind of to the national level.
Mm-hmm.
And why? Why, you know?
I don't, part of it has to goes to my introverted nature, really. I am not a political animal.
Mm-hmm.
I have always found uncomfortable or distasteful some of the political stuff that has to take, you have to take on an aura of some of this to be a national leader. You know, someone like Wayne, who I admire a great deal, she is so skilled at that kind of stuff and can do the political stuff and, you know, talk with people, and I just have never never wanted really to do that. And I've regretted not being willing to do that, because I think I had some things I could have offered to the profession doing it, but I was unwilling to move that far out of my comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I never really have sought a central administrative job of any sort. Department chair is as far as I ever wanted to go, and I usually done that somewhat reluctantly, just because I was in probably the only person to do it at the time and could find myself doing it.
Right.
So I don't know if that helps, but
it
that's
does.
Sort of the stance that I've taken, and I'm not going to change that stance. And I don't do leadership even. I just don't see myself in those kind of roles. I mean, the church that my wife and I go to, they've tried to get me to run for president many times, and that's just not, it's not something. Part of it is, Pat, that I cannot stomach the political stuff that goes on, kind of the niceties that have to be in the air all the time. I like to shoot a little straighter than what you have to do.
Right.
And that kind of stuff always drives me crazy.
Right.
Being president of the Commission of Professors was about as much as I ever wanted to do of that, and I did that only because I really felt duty and honor bound to pay back to the association, and you know, one time was enough. So.
Mm-hmm. I do hear you. In that same section in your responses, you talk about the field in general becoming too diffuse. And can you explain that a little bit more? How is it too diffuse? And
some people would say that is good, I suppose, because when we first started, obviously we were very diffuse. We were borrowing and reformulating knowledge from all the other fields to try to make up our own, and some people have suggested we've become too insular in that we're kind of researching our own navel all the time, and, and I don't quite buy into that myself. I just think that what has happened now, for financial reasons and I suppose political reasons, and sometimes it's been forced upon us by central administration, a lot of the field is having to make allegiances outside of what I call adult education. So you will see a lot of adult education efforts joining in with technology efforts, with vocational education efforts, with instructional design, and I can see, in many respects, I can see an advantage to that. I mean, I can see how there is an advantage to learning from your fellow colleagues and so on and so forth. But because adult education still, as a profession, is a relatively small profession, when you compare us to the medical profession or compare us to general education or something of that nature,
right,
we don't have much of a clout in terms of lobbying, legislation, political clout, being able to lobby in and provide support for politicians, and we just don't have that. And so I can see the advantage of shaking hands. But what happens is whenever those alliances begin to take place, because we don't really have the clout and because a lot of people do not understand the field of adult education.
Right.
And maybe because we're becoming even more diffuse, that will make it even more difficult. We tend to lose out, and I've seen time and again throughout my career where, if we go to the academic side, where academic departments, adult education has been forced to join in with another department, and the other department has a tendency to kind of power it over adult education, and adult education gets the short stick in many respects.
Mm-hmm.
So I would rather see us keep struggling as a profession all on its own, and finding ways of and it's easier said than done, but finding ways of enhancing our clout and our power, I guess, just as a single profession. And I'm sure, Pat, that there are some, there are probably a lot of people who don't agree with me at all on that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's sort of always the stance that I have taken, and I suppose it's the good old days or being conservative or whatever, but I think I now run into a lot of people who kind of call themselves adult educators because they may be doing distance education or they may be working in gerontology, and they say, yeah, I'm an adult educator, and they don't know the first thing about adult education.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't had what I would call an academic course about adult ed, or they don't know about anything about adults as learners. And part of it is our own fault for probably not being better skilled at proselytizing, if that's the right word, getting the word out. But I see, rather than the field kind of growing as a field, I think the diffusing nature of it, of what's going on, is actually shrinking us as a what I'd call a pure adult education field. And I know there are strengths and weaknesses to that. I'm just nervous about what that'll mean in the future. And by the way, I could be all wrong on this.
Right.
I know that. I could be completely all wet on all of this.
No, I actually, some of your concerns about preserving the purity of the field are shared by others. There's no doubt about that. And the way that it seems, like you said, adult ed seems to be merging in with all kinds of other pieces.
Right.
Which it does have its advantages, certainly. But what you hope is happening, or you hope will happen, is that what adult ed has to offer, which is important and powerful, stays strong as it impacts those areas, as opposed to getting pushed aside.
Good hope.
So, I think that's the fear and what seems to tend to happen. I mean, I see it at USF. We're part of leadership development, and leadership development and developing school principals is the priority.
Exactly.
And there's a little bit of adult ed going on there, but I still don't understand why people who are being prepared to be principals who need to be adult educators, but they don't take even one course in adult education.
But they wouldn't understand a word of what you just said. That's the sad part about it.
I'm beginning to learn that.
Right, they don't know what they don't know.
Right.
And as a consequence, they make bonehead mistakes.
Yes.
Because they try to work with adults and they don't know the first thing about it.
Right, exactly. And I'm somebody who's coming to this field in the opposite direction. I was a school administrator.
Oh.
And discovered when I started searching for a doctoral program, I didn't want to get just, and I don't mean to minimize it, but just a doctorate in educational administration. I wanted to, I don't know what I wanted to do, but as I searched for a department, Bill Benjamin here at USF sat down and had a chat with me, and the more I told him about what I liked about being a school administrator, he said, "You're an adult educator." And I said, "I'm a what?"
Yeah.
And that's when he said, "You need to go talk to Wayne James. You don't belong here," you know, in terms of leadership, educational leadership, if you will.
Hey, by the way, we're looking for people like you to spread the word. I mean, you are exactly the kind of people that, coming from administration and understanding now the adult ed field,
exactly,
you're probably much better able to go back and kind of talk the language, so to speak. So future leadership from you, publications, et cetera, will make a big difference. So,
well, we'll see. First, I have to write this dissertation. but I do hear what you're saying. That is, I think, the piece that's missing, in my opinion, is that understanding of where, without losing the purity of adult education that I have come to love and respect, and understand that I have, like you, I've been an adult educator for a long time. I just didn't know it.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand that there was a whole body of knowledge behind what I was sort of learning as I went by the seat of my pants.
Sure.
That I now much better understand. And I believe firmly that it belongs in our training and development of educational leaders. It's definitely a missing link.
Absolutely.
So, we'll see.
Yeah. I don't know. Have will you talk in your research? Is Lucy Guglielmino one of the persons you're going
to
talk with?
She is actually, in terms of where I am trying to as you can understand with a dissertation, trying to keep this framed in a manageable size. And what Wayne and I decided was that there's that Lucy and actually Wayne are kind of just under the line of that next generation. So for me, I probably won't be talking to
her.
The
only reason I bring raise her name is that she has a good grasp of some of the things we're talking about.
Yes, I agree. I was just at the conference with them.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And I don't know how successful she's been, but when she was the, like, the chair of adult ed, and I don't think she is anymore, but when she was the chair of adult ed, she kind of engineered a situation where people in the other areas had to take some adult ed courses, and I don't know how well that worked.
Mm-hmm. And probably from a practical sense, I may speak to her more just for that level of understanding.
Yeah.
But, you know, from a standpoint of formally how am I drawing the lines and the boxes around who I'm speaking to, we kind of have her in that next category down because of where she falls in the actual academic genealogy.
Right, right.
But, yes, I have spoken to her, and we may even have some communication in the near future around some of the other, some of my other interest areas, which are is why I was at the Self-Directed Learning Conference. So
very good.
Yeah. Very nice lady, and I'm anxious to speak with her further. But I think that that generation is probably going to be somebody else's dissertation.
Yeah, you have to keep it manageable.
Yes, definitely. Okay, that was good. That answered a couple pieces of my questions here. My last question on the interview guide that you responded to, and it says, you know, would you add anything else that we haven't covered here? And you kind of suggested some interesting questions that I'm going to throw back at you, if you don't mind. Well, actually, you've covered this already. Key decisions or turning points in your career. I think if unless there's something else that comes to mind that we haven't talked about along those lines.
Not at the moment.
Okay. I'm just going to look back over this again to see if I have any. My overall two areas right now that are coming forth, as you can probably hear from my questions, are about the mentoring relationship that you both gained and, you know, attempted to, I guess we didn't. Do you have anything more to add regarding, you've talked a lot about what you got from Meyer Henry and from McCluskey, of course, in particular. What about what you have attempted to give to your students, to develop in them, to model for them? Do you want to add anything to that? I think I feel like we've covered it, but...
The students that I sensed were probably going to go on as professors, people like Nancy Gadbo and Ralph Brockett and Bert Siskel and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I made it a special point to, when they were students, just as I think as Howard had done with me, I think each of those three that I just mentioned, and there are probably some others that I, if I thought about it, of having them do some co-teaching with me when they were still a student in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And but I typically tried to go farther and have them do some co-authoring with me. And I think probably in the case of at least a couple of them, we've done that. Or I would ask them, if I was editing something, ask them to contribute to it in some way. So
mm-hmm.
I made a more overt effort on the research writing scholarship side. That's always been a long interest of mine, and I actually, I don't do it right now with Elmira College, but when I was at Syracuse University, I used to teach almost every year a three-credit course on professional writing and publishing, and actually co-authored a book on that topic several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always been interested in helping people develop their writing and publishing skills, and made an effort to try to push and trump that in some way, and always tried to encourage students to go to at least one national meeting during their graduate school days.
Right.
But I think that's, you just get something different out of a national meeting than you would a local or a state meeting.
Mm-hmm. And very good point. Actually, that's one of the requirements in our program. We have to, before the program is over, regardless, actually, if you're going on attempt or if you're intending to become a professor. But the attendance, and of course, if you can go further and, you know, write a paper, present, whatever, that's always even better. But at least attending
Absolutely.
A national-level conference.
Good for Wayne and
yeah.
whoever else props that.
Wayne, that's definitely Wayne, because as you know, she's been very involved over the years at the national level. So, yeah, that's definitely one of her requirements. And I've appreciated it. I've actually attended a couple and, of course, presented at AERC, which was a wonderful experience. Let's see. There was another question that popped in my head as you were talking. I should have written it. About students. Oh, I want to go back, if you don't mind, and revisit for a minute the whole idea of national organizations. One person I spoke to mentioned that he felt one of the problems has been that there was not a lot of encouragement for people to organize on a local level so that you had a strong, you know, say a state-level organization to build up the national-level organization. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Or do I ever. When I was, the 2 years I was the commission of professors, and then a couple years before that, I had been elected as a regional representative to AEA and had gone to some of the national meetings. And I wasn't alone. I and others were, in fact, talking about the whole notion of how do you promote more local and regional support. And so trying to form, I think I even wrote a proposal somewhere along the line. It didn't go anywhere of developing chapters, if you want to call them that, at the local level that would have an actual membership in a national organization. And I don't know why, Pat, that didn't go forward.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose people were too busy trying to run the national organization and just didn't feel that they had the energy or so to devote to that. But it makes such a good intuitive sense to try to do something like that.
Right.
And, here in Syracuse area, I and one of my colleagues several years ago now formed a local adult education group. I mean, we're just called the Coalition of Adult and Continuing Education in Central New York. And even at this local level, we've talked about trying to find a national organization that we could have an allegiance with, and we just never have gotten anywhere on it. I think you've raised an excellent question, and that probably is someone else's dissertation down the road to try to figure out why that hasn't happened. I suppose it takes a certain amount of energy and dollars and so on to make it all happen, and no one had the time and the ability to do it. But,
right.
Boy, wouldn't that be wonderful? I can't imagine that it wouldn't help everybody if
yeah.
a national organization would, like, look what ASTD does.
Right,
has
exactly.
has all these local chapters around the country, and adult ed national organizations never have been able to do that. There are state associations and some regional associations,
yes.
but getting down at the local level, it's never really happened.
Mm-hmm. And even, I mean, and as you just said, there are some state associations, some regional associations, but there isn't, not all over the country. It just seems to be wherever they've cropped up in somebody's work to organize them and kept them going. And
yeah.
that's actually intrigued me in talking to Glenn Jensen. He was played a critical role in forming the regional organization that exists out there that is still very strong.
At Mountain Plains.
Yes, and you know, they have their own publication, and that's a nice way for students to break the ice and stay connected.
Yeah.
It intrigues me also because, again, as a school administrator, I was in special education and in the state of New Jersey, and we had just that kind of linkage. Those of us that ran special ed facilities in New Jersey had a local state organization that was part of a national organization, and you know, we would meet on a regular basis, and it was a great colleague development, idea, think tank, all those kinds of things, resources. And on the local level, it's manageable because you don't have to necessarily have the funds to travel nationally if that's not in your wherewithal, but at least most of the time locally, you could just drive to the meeting.
Exactly.
And so it's cost-wise and everything else, it's an efficient way to collaborate and you know, link up and everything. So
I don't know what your last chapter turns out to be. In a dissertation, you don't know very far in advance what it's going to be until you get there. But
right.
Maybe from your research, you will be able to conceptualize change or come up with recommendations or whatever. This would be a wonderful area for you to talk about and perhaps do some writing about.
That seems to be where it's going, yes. And it's interesting that it comes from a combination of my adult ed learning in the past couple of years, you know, academically, and my experiences in the, you know, field of leadership in education. So, anyway,
well,
that seems to be where it's going. Yes, definitely. I think I have probably finished asking all of my questions. Is there anything, either from the questions I sent you or the things we've talked about today, that you would like to add?
I don't know that anything comes to mind right now. If you don't mind, if something pops up later on, I could send you an email with some thoughts.
That would be wonderful. That would be great.
And I will think about, I'll think some possibilities there.
Okay, terrific.
Good luck, Pat,
great.
With everything you're doing. It sounds like a very interesting project.
Thank you very much, and I, again, appreciate your time and thoughts, and I'll look forward to anything further. And also, is it all right if a question pops up as I go along? Because as you know, with this kind of a study, somebody's going to say something, and I might think, gee, I wonder what Rod Heemstra thinks about that. So if you don't mind, I may recontact you.
Right, email will be the best, probably.
Great, okay.
I'm going to be doing a fair amount of traveling over the next 6 weeks.
Okay, well, enjoy that, and safe travels to you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Good luck with everything.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.